You know, Dan, I often slide my little cursor right down over my toolbar on the bottom of my screen just to remind myself what day it is. Even when I know, it's just sort of habit. And I did it now knowing, no, it's the 14th. It's
definitely the 14th.
Among the more famous days of the year, the more memorable. The day that the woman I'm married to now, I've been valentining since I was 16 years old back in 1983. So I've had that drilled into my mind, you know, you don't miss that day, February 14th. But still,
as long as I've been alive, that's pretty neat. I was born in 1983.
Well, we started dating in June 1983.
July 1st is when I was born. So
jeez.
Maybe you had your first date on my birthday. I don't know.
I mean, if things had gone, you know, terribly wrong, could have had a child your age. goodness no. But hey, happy Valentine's Day to you. If you carry any Valentine's Day trauma, sorry about that.
Happy Valentine's Day or condolences, either one.
Fourth grade, our class, our teacher had everyone put Valentine's in kids, you know, little bags.
You make a little shoebox or something.
Yeah. I seem to remember ours was a lunch bag. I only had two in my one from the teacher and one from Anne Barry. That was it. I was not a liked kid in fourth grade. I don't know.
That's rough.
I'm just gonna swallow hard and bury those emotions and have a big lunch later to get rid of them. And then I guess teachers don't do that stuff anymore. I think they find a way to make sure, you know, that kids aren't just, you know,
Given. We had a whole list of everyone in my daughter's class, and you got to get everyone a
even if your Valentine. Kid is like, I'm not giving him a Valentine. You are. Well, happy Valentine's Day, the most made up holiday of them all. I mean, it just ranks right up there with Father's Day. All the other ones, really good reason to exist. Valentine's Day, come on. But it's a sweet, sweet little holiday. So
and there's worse things you could celebrate, I guess.
Totally. It could be like Second Amendment Day or something like that.
Don't give them any ideas.
You know why there's not. It's like, you know, it's like Kids Day. When you're a kid, did you ever ask your parents, like after Mother's Day and Father's Day, how come there's not a Kids Day?
Why not?
I used to say that to my dad, and he said, every day is freaking Kids Day. All we do is feed kids.
Every day is Second Amendment Day around
here.
Every day
is Second Amendment Day for the Second Amendment people. They don't want a special day. They want to make sure it's, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. And you know, it comes at a good time in the year and all that, and in a very sports focused time with the Olympics going on.
Yeah.
And of course, yesterday you can't say the official name of this without possibility of being sued by the nonprofit organization that is the National Football League. You can't. Speak the name, say the name, write the name. You have to call it the big game or something else. You know, all this, like
the actual phrase or word is trademarked.
You can't say Super Bowl. And I just got flagged right now. Way back in the, yeah, that's right. Way back in the 90s, we had the church I worked at as a youth pastor, and we had a night, you know, a Sunday night to watch the Super Bowl and had big screens and that kind of stuff. And man, ran into all measure of trouble around that.
Oh, yeah, just trying to show the game to 10 youth group kids. So it's like,
yeah, totally.
Oh, they're out to get you.
Or just trying to, you know, describe it in the church newsletter as the Super Bowl. You can't. You got to refer to it as the big game because they litigate all that stuff, or apparently claim to. Mm-hmm. But that's not really the biggest sporting event yesterday. I think the biggest sporting event was, you know, from the Discovery Channel, the Puppy Bowl. And Team Fluff sinks baby teeth into victory. I mean, that thing is just the most adorable, isn't it? That they do a Puppy Bowl. I've never watched it, but you know, now with the, you know, frequency of images that come flailing by my life, you just get to see them. And this year, I'm reading off of a news article about it, was the largest competition of puppies, with more than 100 dogs from 63 shelters in 33 states. And none of these dogs are trained in anything. They just put them out there. And the goal is whatever dog drags a chew toy into the end zone and wins. And then all the other rules and you know, things that they have to decide on are all made up on the fly just to avoid.
That's great.
And to make cuteness.
Yeah. So I like that.
So much better. So much better. You know, just cute little dogs running around doing cute dog things.
We need more of that in the world.
But, you know, instead yesterday it was just a team that really believed in each other and dug down deep and played well. Did you watch the Super Bowl yesterday?
I did, yeah. Yeah, I watched it. Watched the first half with some friends, some elder millennials and Gen Xers. And so we were all very thrilled with the halftime show.
Oh, man.
I wasn't super invested in who won. I was kind of cheering for the Bengals just because of the underdog story. But, man, once you got to halftime.
Boom. Boy, that was really something. I'll tell you, I put on my Facebook feed, best halftime show, Super Bowl halftime show ever, I think, something like that. Right. And I post a lot of things on the social media channels, especially on Facebook.
Fairly controversial at times. But,
oh, really?
But none so controversial as this comment, apparently.
Most just go without, you know, any engagement. As of, you know, like 14 minutes after posting that, 43 comments.
People had opinions.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know if this ever happens to you where you have a sort of a post that more people tend to like just write stuff about. All of a sudden, people I hadn't heard from since, you know, 2008 when I joined Facebook.
Totally.
Are like, well, Prince, that one, how about that one, you know, or a thumbs up or something. I'm like, wow. Yeah. Just a reminder at what a collective spectacle the Super Bowl is.
Mm-hmm.
Just amazing amount of people that care about that thing. And I'm not big into hip hop. I don't know hip hop music. I knew all of these artists. So that says something about its crossover appeal, you know, that's for an audience much, much broader. I don't know how many times you Googled this last night, like I did. Like, how old is Snoop Dogg? How old is Mary Blige? How old is Eminem? Did you?
They're in their 50s, I think.
Yeah,
yeah.
49 for Eminem, 51 for Mary.
Mary J.
I didn't look at Kendrick Lamar. I think he's in his 24.
Yeah.
Snoop Dogg is 50. Dr. Dre is 56. So, you know, hip hop finally gets its center stage, and it's, you know, for people in there. Also by the AARP,
me and my friends were sitting around. We're like, finally, a Super Bowl show that's relevant and cool that everyone can get behind. And then you sent this meme, said, if you're stoked about this halftime show, it's time to book your colonoscopy. We sort of realized, like, oh, we're the old audience now that they're targeting. It's like back when, you know, they had the Rolling Stones or whatever.
Yeah, or, you know, whoever it was, Springsteen, Prince. Prince seems to be a standout for a lot of people that didn't seem so age specific. And maybe it's just because I know a lot of people who are really connected to Prince being in Minneapolis, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Prince was probably the best halftime show. Playing Purple Rain in the rain.
In the rain.
And he's just shredding this insane guitar solo in the rain.
Alone on a stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was epic. But
a close second.
Totally. Partly because what I liked about this one is it was just a halftime show celebration. It didn't take itself quite as seriously. Like Snoop Dogg coming out and his head, you know, just
just having a good time.
I can't speak to his blood chemistry situation at the time, but just looked like a guy that was, you know, using some of the newly approved California recreational chemicals. He just, the whole thing was, it wasn't so, sometimes it feels like those halftime shows are something more than honoring a musical act after its years and, you know, just trying to do more. It's not a concert. It's a great little show. And all those people in it, 50 Cent coming in, hanging upside down. Come on. That's just all these little homages to videos from, I don't know, whatever, 1992 or 94 or something, 96. That was just, I thought, really, really fun. And I felt like you wouldn't have to know a lot about the music to just be like, it was visually fun. It was positive feeling. It just seemed really great.
Yeah. There was speculation though, even before the show started, how are certain audiences going to respond to this? Like, what are they going to find to be mad about? And Charlie Kirk called it sexual anarchy, called the halftime show sexual anarchy. But this is where, you know, it was another unifying moment of the Super Bowl that liberals and conservatives have united to dunk on this take. Because It was just like a fun party. It wasn't anything crazy or promiscuous or...
There's the kind of dancing that you do that some people interpret to be overly sexual. But look, the Buddhists are right that you see the world as you are much more than seeing the world as it is. So if you saw that as sexual anarchy, well, you know, have a little chat with whoever your spiritual or psychological counselor is about how it is, you know. Because, my friend, sometimes a cigar is just simply a cigar, as Freud was trying to say. Like that, remember 2 years ago, though? I remember being on the Vote Common Good bus. I don't remember where we were, but the Super Bowl show, which then I think I posted greatest Super Bowl halftime ever. I think it was J-Lo. And that thing, remember that one?
Vaguely.
Oh, really? Oh, dude. If somebody had written Super Bowl is, you know, sexual, that one had a little sexual vibe. Remember the Puerto Rican flag and everything? Oh, it was just a spectacular, but this is the problem with halftime shows. Yeah, look, how many years ago was it that Janis Jackson, you know, the FAA or the FCC had to get involved because of Nipplegate, you know, when her shirt came down.
Wardrobe malfunction.
Yeah, wardrobe malfunction. It's supposed to be fun and party kind of atmosphere. It's the Super Bowl halftime show of all things. What do you think this whole dealio is? I thought really great. Congratulations to, you know, the billion-dollar franchises that spend all their money for one team to win over the other at the last minute.
Yeah, good for them. And it seems like the right team won, because here's a little fun fact for you. The Bengals owner, Mike Brown, contributed the maximum $5,600 to Donald Trump's reelection, while the Rams' COO, Kevin Dimoff, gave $2,800 to Democratic presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg, my boy.
He only gives it to Buttigieg. He doesn't even give him the full $5,600.
Didn't max it out, but we'll take what we can get.
He kicked it a little $2,800
of his multi-millions.
Yeah. But you're right. Look, I mean, people scrutinize this kind of thing. And I saw some other article. I don't know the validity of it, but it was basically like, two great teams with two horrible owners. So I don't know the background on the owners.
Yeah. If you dig anywhere below the surface of the NFL, it's all hot garbage. It's just like
trashy owners. I mean, just.
Yeah. And racism and terrible people that are very wealthy. Yeah.
Which again, just brings us back to the, you know, puppy bowl. You just had none of that. There was no drama. This was like. No drama. Just like Super Bowl III back in the day. The team that is represented by the state that I live in, the Minnesota Vikings, we were in the Super Bowl a couple of times back in the 60s or 70s and never won. And during the Super Bowl, they had a promo for a news piece coming saying, you know, Bud Grant, who was then the coach, does an interview about, you know, what you learned from the Super Bowl. I thought back when the Vikings were in the Super Bowl, a lot of the NFL players, this wasn't even their only job, I think. I mean, I'm not even sure being a professional football player was, you know,
maybe the quarterback was making enough to but the really linemen, they were having to deliver pizzas.
Yeah, they were working at the grocery store in the off season for sure. They were butchers and bakers and those kinds of people. So this whole thing has become, you know, I heard a news story yesterday. It was on Freakonomics Radio, so it wasn't really a news story, but it was a radio story. And it was about how specialization is the thing that's allowed the United States to become a successful nation over the last couple hundred years. We've made a decision to really have people specialize in certain skills. Mm-hmm. And the example they were giving was in the NFL, the newly discovered value of the long snapper, the person that snaps the ball for punts and for field goals, that now has become a specialized role where they have to go recruit certain people. It has just gotten to the point of, you know, probably because the athleticism is so high and the game is so restricted and there's only so many things you can do.
Yeah, to improve and get an edge. Yeah.
I mean, I will say this, as someone who thinks the Super Bowl or the NFL is a really damaged brand and that our treatment of sports is indicative of lots of things in our society that should be different. The athleticism of NFL players is pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. Like just the things they're able to do inside of a very contained set of rules is really remarkable. Throwing those balls, catching them, running by people, just tackling someone, simply being tackled and then getting up and going again. It's, you know, maybe back in my 20s, I could, you know, I was fine being slammed to the ground, even with pads on, and then just pop right back up. But
yeah,
man, I watched both quarterbacks, I think, took serious bends and dips to their knees and ankles. And like, oh my gosh.
How are they still walking? Yeah.
Yeah, that's incredible. So, okay, all that to say, but
and,
still.
You know, it's let people have fun. Let people enjoy things in this, you know, desolate wasteland of COVID. And
yeah, that's a good point. Good point. Just the Puppy Bowl is fun too, though, and there's just none of that other nonsense going on. I guess that's what sort of irks me about the NFL is does it really have to be all the other things that it is for people to have fun? But I'll say the thing that I'm not finding very much fun myself are the Winter Olympics. Are you watching them?
I was just going to say, talking about something that isn't, you know, a massive spectacle, but that is pretty fun. The U.S. curling team. Like, have you watched any curling?
In my life, I'm in Minnesota, so it's like half.
Oh yeah, you're from
Minnesota.
Curling Mecca,
are curlers. So yeah, I mean, I haven't watched it this Olympics.
Part of the appeal is the mustaches and the hair. I don't know if you've seen the team, but pretty incredible mustache and mane situation. And they just looked like a bunch of dads that, you know, had a club and somehow stumbled their way into the Olympics. And I think that's great.
And now it's an Olympic sport.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. My commentary on the Olympics should be thrown out, you know, with the daily, you know, fish paper. But the things they have to do to make the Olympics continue to be, including more sports and more people and making sure there's equity across the genders, has just turned it into something that feels ridiculous to me, you know. Now the mono bobsled, you know, is a big thing, trying to get some news because the woman who won the single person in the bobsled, like, it just has become when sports are this obscure, you know, like the people skiing and shooting, I can't remember what that's called.
Yeah.
That's just, I mean, it's been around for a long time. So like, I get it, but that sort of thing, or of course all the snowboarding kind of variations and tricks and competitions built in within that. So many of these sports feel like things that I would see on a YouTube video or a Facebook video feed where it's like, here's an incredible sport where, you know, people bump a ball across a net with just their chest. It just feels like obscure sports to me. So maybe I'm kind of missing. I'm not saying they shouldn't have them. They're just not all that interesting, you know, to watch the, and even curling is like, what a strange, strange sport to have be at the
I've watched a fair amount just because it takes the longest to complete a match. I think it's on the most, like, it gets the most airtime because it just takes forever to do. And so I was folding laundry the other day and it just happened to be on for like an hour. And I still don't know how the scoring works. Like, you got the two rings and I still couldn't tell you.
Okay. Well, happy Olympics.
Happy Olympics.
Does it end Sunday or Friday?
This is the last week, I think. But man, the snowboarding has been really fun to watch.
Yeah,
just incredible to watch. They're doing flips and spins like you've never seen, Doug.
I can imagine. I'll spend a little time this week catching up.
Watch the highlights of the snowboarding.
That's been part of the thing I haven't wanted to do is to watch the NBC coverage. I don't know if other people watch the NBC coverage, but that all that prepackaged stuff and all the backstories and the drama that they do around it, and just the human interest.
I don't care about where they come from.
Could not care. Thank you. I feel terrible saying that, so I'm glad that somebody will voice it for me. It's almost like they've taken a page from the back, and this was years before. It's not just this year. They've been doing this for years. It's like a page from, you know, reality TV or The Bachelor or something, like trying to get you hooked into the story of these folks. And I don't know. It starts tapping your nationalism, you know, like we should really be rooting for this team over the other, and you know, this person. So anyway, not really my. Really my thing. But other people love it. I'm sure there's comments in here, of people that know how to appreciate the Winter Olympics for all the Winter Olympics. Hey, but here's something I didn't notice too much in the Super Bowl or have heard too much about in the Olympics, short of, you know, they live in a bubble as inside the Olympic Village. And that's COVID. It feels like, Dan, that COVID is coming to its final days in this country, at least this Omicron version. And, you know, if another one flares up, but boy, it feels like in the last 3 weeks, it has just, the numbers have crashed. The deaths are starting now to decline. Hospitalizations are getting back to something more reasonable. Mm-hmm. And all indications are that hospitals are going to return to normal levels, which, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit later. It's not as if the medical industry has, you know, solved for future pandemic problems.
Yeah, it's not like things were great before the pandemic either.
Yeah, I mean, running such tight margins, you know, mm-hmm. just seems to be not the way you take care of a health system in a nation of our size and of our economy. It just seems like, but overall, the COVID numbers, boy, it seems like it's going the right way. Seems like we're going to be done. I think now the fight, the struggle is going to be for the people who will want to preserve mask wearing indefinitely. And I only say that as a slight exaggeration. I mean, there are people for whom the idea that anyone will ever get COVID is something that all of us have a personal responsibility to have to wear a mask to prevent. And I'm starting to hear that, especially amongst the people who are been very vigilant about mask wearing, and rightly so, during the height of the pandemic. I don't know how they ever turn that off. And I mean, I'm hearing lots of sort of people in the media talking about, boy, it's way too soon to be taking off masks. I'm not doing that. And then they name, you know, the reasons why, because mm-hmm. vulnerable people, which is true. But at some point, I don't know how, Do you think we should sort of stick with, hey, masks are the norm when you're in public spaces, as opposed to masks being something only invoked when there's a true pandemic that is rivaling or is attacking the health system?
Yeah, I don't see any viable way to continue mask mandates on a large scale, but I could see things like, you know, maybe you should wear a mask on the subway when you're crammed in with a bunch of people. I can see something like that sticking around. Mm-hmm. But the CDC even has, you know, issued new guidelines, and it's really pretty fuzzy. Like, there's like five variables that you have to take into consideration, like whether or not you should wear a mask in a place. And so it seems like things are really becoming what they always were, which is you do what you think is best based on the information you have.
Yeah.
The problem is getting good information. And that's where this idea of a COVID forecast is really interesting, because it seems to be, you know, it goes in waves, and certain areas of the country are, you know, dealing with it more than others. Maybe we view it as like pollen count and gauge whether or not you should mask up or alter your behavior in some other way.
Yeah, look, it's we've never had a good forecast. And what's up on the screen for people that are watching there is this was an article that was advocating for us having something more like a weather forecast. And we haven't had that and it's been something I've been surprised at. Early on, I think we generally agreed, sort of April, May, June of 2020, that we needed to bend the curve because the numbers were going up, and that was all to make sure that the hospitalizations didn't overwhelm our system. We didn't have treatments and didn't have prevention in vaccines, or even knowing what particular actions would cause transmission of the virus. Because remembering back to December 2019, where the 19 of COVID comes from, the year, and January and February, early March, all of the health experts in the United States believed that nothing like a coronavirus would be spread by people who were non-symptomatic. This was the big argument. And all of those people have now said, we had that wrong. It mm-hmm. turns out that the COVID vaccine was transmissible, is transmissible, even when you don't show symptoms. So early on, it was all about symptoms, right? And that's what prevented the United States from invoking any kind of action in January and February and even early March. Was they said, well, the number of the people that have symptoms isn't very high, so we don't believe the virus is here and all that level of intensity. Then all of a sudden, these symptoms just showed up by the hundreds of thousands, especially in certain locations like New York. And it became clear, oh, people are passing this asymptomatically.
Right.
There's some great news stories about China trying to say to the World Health Organization, and specifically the United States, this is being passed asymptomatically. And because of the knowledge at the time that was assured to be correct, they didn't follow that advice. Mm-hmm. That was a huge, huge setback for the United States. Then we started to figure out, well, what's it going to take to prevent the spread of this? Remember setting our packages outside and not wanting to have delivery surfaces? I don't know that but still in lots of places, there's this whole thing about wiping down surfaces and washing hands and so on. I don't know where the medical evidence is on that, scientific evidence is, if coronavirus is passed that way. What we do know is that it's passed through spittle and it's passed through the air, but predominantly mm-hmm. through vapor, liquid vapors in the air. More commonly, more heavy levels of spittle. And that just gets passed in lots of environments by people. So masks certainly made a whole lot of sense. But is that something that we're going to want to say to one another? And are we going to have a society by which people are free to wear a mask if you want, or to not wear a mask if you don't want? Mm-hmm. That is going to be... I think long after the COVID numbers have declined and we've said we've bent the curve again and we are no longer in jeopardy by any, you know, by best case scenarios of overwhelming the health system, what's going to happen with mask wearing? And I think it's going to continue to be a real bone of contention with people. There's going to be a lot of frustration around people who don't wear masks, and then people who are wearing masks. People are going to get irritated when somebody wears a mask. They're going to revert to like Trump in 2020 when someone's wearing a mask, right? Remember when he was saying stuff like, hey, to the reporters, like, take your mask off. How come you're wearing a mask? You're afraid? Remember that? Yeah. That's going to come back now. People are going to be like, hey, it's time for you to stop that mask wearing. And then other people are going to be saying, I believe you have to keep wearing a mask. We still have too many vulnerable people. And I don't know how, as a society, we're going to ever sort of move forward on this. It's really going to be... So while COVID feels like it's moving into the background as a pandemic, what's the word they use for it? An endemic?
Endemic.
Endemic, meaning it's around like the flu or other things that we just learn to live with it, but it's not at a pandemic level. Boy, this is going to be a real... cultural cross point. I think it's going to cause all kinds of consternation at work, at churches. I went the other mm-hmm. night to a monster jam where
like monster trucks, right?
Monster trucks. Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable. A little boring, frankly. I was surprised at that because it just was a little bit repetitious. But these trucks are unreal. Like they do tricks and stuff, you know, and these big tires and these big crazy trucks. So it was at this football stadium here in Minneapolis. So big, huge stadium like that. And there was a mask mandate in place. Everybody had to wear a mask. When we went in, I would say 50% of the people had a mask on. No one was enforcing it. Mm-hmm. By the end, because you could take it off for eating and drinking. And by the end, walking out, I had my mask on. I counted maybe six other people in the crowd of, I don't know, hundreds that were milking together, you know, moving together through the corridors. You know, we're all jammed mm-hmm. now in the little corridors, walking out and going down the escalators. Maybe six or seven people that had a mask on at that point. It was just tens of thousands of people inside in a place where the posted signs were masks are required. No enforcement, nobody wearing them. Yeah. And I didn't pick up any real weird vibe, you know, where people were like, hey, take your mask off. But I don't know. I feel like without some agreement about when and how we take off masks or stop certain protocols, and it's just kind of at the decision of lawmakers or rule makers, you know, whoever makes the rules, people that run an organization or a business or a mm-hmm. city or county or state. I don't know. I think we're in, I feel like that piece we've never really handled well to mark by what standards our decisions going to be made.
Yeah. And that's the frustrating part too, is when there were statewide mask mandates for indoor places or countywide, it gave businesses kind of the cover to say, hey, we're not the bad guy, but please just help us out, wear your mask. Now, when it comes back to it's on each individual business and storefront to enforce and decide who should wear a mask and can you come in if you're not wearing a mask, it's going to lead to so many angry Karen moments and
totally.
It's just going to be more of that mess. Like, you can't tell me how to,
yeah,
what to do.
Look, there's a nice comment. I was thinking the same thing from PJ Bird in the chat here, where PJ reminds us that Japanese folks have been wearing masks for years on airplanes and in other public places. I mean, in Japanese culture, it's very common to see people. I think Chinese culture as well. For years, I've watched people wearing those masks. So it's just kind of normative.
Yeah, and it seems like a good idea. COVID aside, everyone's got tons of other germs that I don't want. So I'm going to keep wearing a mask when I'm in small enclosed places with large groups of strangers.
Yeah, I don't know. It's going to be, I wonder how well we're going to accommodate to it. Yeah, it felt like 6 months ago, 9 months ago, when the summer was coming, remember, and it felt like masks were coming to, or COVID was coming to an end, and, you know, almost had a mission accomplished moment from the Biden team. It felt like people were like, man, am I even going to keep my mask? Like, am I going to have it around? And I think Omicron was sort of like, yeah, probably don't want to throw that thing away yet. This could surge at different, mm-hmm. at different moments. But it's kind of the big news story that, frankly, I know everyone is tired of it. I mean, I'm certainly in that camp. I just want this to be over. But there's a lot of things I'm tired of that aren't over. And I don't know. I don't know where this goes, because I've had more friends that I personally know get sick with COVID in the last 3 months than I did in the first, whatever, 12, like by far. There was a long period of time where I'm like, I don't know anyone who's gotten COVID yet. It's really amazing. Now it's just like bing, 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 Omicron just all over my vaccinated people. The most careful people that I know in my world have contracted COVID. Mm-hmm. And they have done everything meticulously.
Yeah, everything by the book.
Yeah. And the thing I've been very helped by, I just heard one NIH person, I think, say, you have to distinguish between infection and disease. Early on in a pandemic, the distinction between infection and disease is not as important. But in an endemic, it's extremely important. In other words, having the infection is not a thing to be concerned about. Your body will respond to it. It will take care of it. Disease that comes from your body's crisis around the infection, that's what you want to prevent. So vaccines are predominantly there to prevent disease and in part to prevent the spread of infection. But the whole thing about people reaching a level at which our society can move forward is that we can be infected by any manner of viruses mm-hmm. and move on. And this has been the moving line over and over with COVID, is are people comfortable with folks getting infected? Because the people who don't want us to return to anything that looks like it used to look in our behavior are often saying, but infections still happen. And then other people say, but those infections are not leading to a level of disease that we don't have a response to, either because the medical system is overwhelmed or because of treatments. So yes, you're going to have a certain number of people, like with the flu or like with other diseases that are airborne via infections. Mm-hmm. And this is really the question, is can we start to distinguish between, I think there's even three categories for the public health people: infections, disease, and then death. Right. And what you really want to preserve is death, which we have not done well in this country. The next is disease that has to be treated at a medical level. And preventing infection might not be the only way to do that. You have to do that for a short period of time because it's going to spread like wildfire through a system.
Right.
Okay. Just one more thought on this. And were you going to say something?
Well, the frustrating thing is, you know, there's a lot of evidence that says, like, if we had done a hard lockdown for 2 or 3 weeks in the very early days, we could have nipped this in the bud. And at any point along this, yeah, the last 2 years, if we had decided, okay, everyone's going to lock down except for the bare essential employees that need to keep the wheels on this thing, we could have been done with it. But now we're left with continuing to fight these battles and kind of half measures that don't quite do it. Mm-hmm. And leaving it up to the individuals in our society to determine what level of care they're going to take for each other. And I feel like we've failed that test as a society. Like, so many people have said, I'm not willing to do even the bare minimum to protect my neighbors. And that's been really disheartening.
Yeah, I've concluded this is the best this country could ever do on this issue. With all things taken into consideration, it wasn't perfect, never would be, but this is about as good as it's going to get. This mm-hmm. number of people getting vaccinated, this number of, like, this is just how this country is going to roll. And what's been confusing to me about this whole dynamic is back in the fall, the public health people predicted that Omicron would peak in January and then start to decline in February. Like, they knew it. They know how viruses like this spread, and their predictions were incredibly accurate. And what it didn't seem to follow was behavior, either around mask wearing or vaccinations. So there are people trying to take all kinds of credit, and some people trying to apply all kinds of blame for the behavior, but the people who study the movement of viruses are like, oh, this is just how it's going to move. And it almost doesn't matter on the grand scale of how long it's going to be around. It might matter for an individual. It might matter for a vulnerable community, what you do. And separating out the difference between what a vulnerable community is, how a vulnerable community is impacted versus what's going to stop the overall arc of a virus. The overall arc of a virus doesn't seem to be affected by the select peculiarities, like one state did a lockdown, another, because there's been all this competition, right? Like California locked down and Florida didn't, and then watch the numbers, and you know, in 1 month it's up in one place and then down, and then the next month it's up in another, and you just can't land it as simply as in places where they did these practices, this is what happened, in places where they utilized these practices, this is what happened. It doesn't work like that as a pandemic. It might work like that to protect a nursing home or to protect a school. But man, some of the places where you would think the virus is really going to spread, airplanes, come on. I mean, how is it possible that people who work in the whole industry of travel, airplanes, airports, hotel, all that, the numbers have not peaked in that sector at all. They've peaked in like sectors, you know, food production and and other places. So it is a confusing, to just the common sense person, it's a confusing set of realities that we can't just simply say, look, we know what works. I think we know what works for an individual to be benefited and the best way to protect, which is to get vaccinated and to limit your amount of infection possibilities.
Yeah.
As a pandemic as a whole, man, short of had we